Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Las Vegas.
It's more than just a city.
It's a feeling.
It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the Strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Over 42 million people from around the world share that feeling every year.
And I'm one of them.
Taking you to the world-famous Vegas Strip and beyond, my name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to From the Vault, a special series of episodes of Jeff Does Vegas. Over the 5 years I ran this podcast, from 2019 to 2024, I released over 180 episodes. And along the way, I talked to some very cool Vegas insiders, entertainers, and local experts. I also shared lots of tips and travel advice and explored the fascinating history of the city. I thought it might be fun to take a little trip back in time and reshare some of those episodes. So, whether you're a longtime follower looking for a re-listen, or you're a Vegas fanatic who just happened to stumble across the show, welcome. I hope you'll stick around for this conversation from the vault. Although the city of Las Vegas has a relatively short history, its past is filled with some incredibly colorful characters. And this time around, I want to share the story of one of them. Howard Hughes was a billionaire businessman, movie producer, aviator, and philanthropist. He was also a bit eccentric, to say the least. The stories about Howard Hughes are legendary. We've heard everything from him urinating in mason jars and having foot-long fingernails, to locking himself in a movie studio screening room for months on end and buying a Las Vegas hotel because he didn't want to leave. The stories have been around so long and spun in so many different directions that sometimes it's hard to separate fact from fiction. And that's where my guest for this episode of the podcast comes into play. Jeff Schumacher is the Vice President of Exhibits and Programs for the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas. In addition to Las Vegas's mob history, another one of Jeff's fields of expertise is the subject of Howard Hughes and his time spent in Las Vegas. When did Hughes start spiraling into a world of germophobia and OCD? What prompted him to make the move to Las Vegas in the first place? Did he really buy the Silver Slipper Hotel and Casino because the sign annoyed him? And what was his reason behind purchasing a Las Vegas TV station? We get the answers to these questions and many more. Please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Schumacher.
Howard Hughes is, a subject that I have been focused on since the late 90s, and there's so many stories, so I'm not sure where to begin.
Well, let's start with his pre-Vegas years. I mean, a lot of people know Howard Hughes as this eccentric billionaire inventor, a little bit crazy, got some weird stories and some weird legends surrounding him. One of the big things that he was involved with before he got to Las Vegas was the world of filmmaking. What piqued his interest in filmmaking? Why did he decide he wanted to get into movies?
Well, I think the original impetus for his interest in movies was his uncle, Rupert. Rupert Hughes was a very well-known screenwriter and director during the silent film era. And he lived in Hollywood, and Howard would come as a youth with his father and mother, and they would visit Uncle Rupert. And Rupert, at that time, you know, people have not heard of Rupert Hughes today, but at the time, he was very well known. He was front page news in any kind of celebrity sense. And so, visiting him, going to movie sets, I think definitely created an interest in the subject for, and the idea of like doing something new and different in Hollywood. I think that really was in Howard's mind very early on.
So it wasn't just for the starlets then.
That came later.
And I mean, he did all right with movies, right? I mean, it wasn't like he made millions of dollars off of them or smashed box office records at the time. But Hell's Angels was kind of his really big success, correct?
It was. You know, he started in the silent film era, and he created a company called Caddo Productions, and he made several movies. And at the time, he was more of a producer. When it came to the movie Hell's Angels, which is the World War I flying epic, you know, he decided that he would direct. And there are pros and cons to that. On the pro side, he was the director of some of the still most amazing combat flying scenes that have ever been filmed. And so if you go back and watch Hell's Angels, you will see those scenes are riveting. And I think they made a big impact on the movie industry. Now, the downside as a director was that he was terrible with people and with actors and with dialogue. And, you know, you do not really want to watch Hell's Angels for the plot development. You know, it's really all about those flying scenes.
Now, for Howard Hughes, what came first for him? Was it the interest in movies or the interest in aviation, or did the two kind of come together? Because, of course, I think a lot of people know Howard Hughes as particularly after the Leonardo DiCaprio movie as the aviator and his involvement in aviation and aircraft development and things like that.
I think going back to when he was a young boy, Howard was always interested in sort of engineering, taking devices apart and putting them back together, that kind of a kid, to see how they worked. But movies came first. I think he wanted to make movies first and foremost as a young adult. And then when he decided to make Hell's Angels, that really cemented his desire to get involved with aviation. And almost 2 years after the release of Hell's Angels in 1931, he came up with a couple more movies, and then he gave up on the movie industry for a while because he wanted to dedicate all his time to aviation, and he wanted to design planes. He wanted to fly them faster than they'd ever been flown before. And he succeeded in that area. In the mid to late 30s, Howard Hughes was the most accomplished aviator in the country. In 1936, he flew at he set the air speed record, and that same year he flew across the United States in record time. 2 years later, in 1938, he flew around the world in record time. And so, what was interesting about Hughes, and I think why people remember him so fondly as an aviator, is not only was he involved in the development of these airplanes, but he flew them himself. You know, he was the test pilot, and he insisted upon that. So, you know, when they flew around the world, you know, he was the pilot much of the time. He had a crew, but, you know, he was the main guy making all the decisions and flying for, you know, hour after hour after hour as they set the record for, they blew away the record, really. I think they blew away the record by a couple of days.
And him as a test pilot, that didn't always work out all that well for him, did it?
Well, you know, he was a reckless flyer. He was a very good pilot. Everybody sort of agrees on he had the sort of natural talent and desire to fly planes. And he flew everything from a little tiny little plane up to obviously the biggest plane in the world. We'll get to that. But he was a little reckless. And part of that was he was flying experimental aircraft. So something that was, you know, it was coming right out of just being built right there. And he was the test pilot. So he was putting himself inherently in danger flying a plane that had never been flown before, you know. So there were accidents. In 1943, he had a pretty serious accident at Lake Mead, south of Las Vegas. in which he landed his plane on the water and crashed, and one of his wingtips hit the water, and then the plane started turning, and two men ended up dying from that accident. And then 3 years later, he was involved in a very serious accident in Los Angeles, where his plane crashed into the Los Angeles Country Club. And in that case, Hughes was by himself in the plane. And he, when he hit the ground, the plane was in flames and Hughes was badly hurt. He climbed out of the cockpit somehow on his own. And then a young Marine who happened to hear the crash and was nearby ran up and pulled him away from the wreckage before he got, you know, before he burned to death. He ended up going to the hospital there were doctors that evening who were telling the press, we don't think he's going to make it. That's how serious the injuries were.
And that's the crash I think that people are probably most familiar with, because, again, coming back to the movie The Aviator, that crash, I think, was portrayed in that film, wasn't it?
Absolutely was. And I think it was a major turning point in his life as well. Hughes was, you know, he had broken bones. He had third degree burns. He had internal bleeding. He was in very bad shape. And the interesting thing about that, he was in the hospital for about 6 weeks. And then he walked out of his own power after about 6 weeks.
Wow.
He really, with all the injuries that he had, he should have stayed in the hospital probably 6 months, honestly. But he was Howard Hughes and he was stubborn and he walked out. What he brought with him, though, were painkillers, morphine, codeine, and other pills that counteracted the ill effects of those. So he ended up becoming, you know, it wasn't long after that he became addicted to painkillers. And this affected the rest of his life.
Just sticking with aviation for a hot minute here, because I am a raging aviation nerd. I want to talk about just briefly the Spruce Goose.
Yes.
I had a chance to see that aircraft several years ago at the Evergreen Aviation Museum in McMinnville in Oregon. And I don't think people realize quite how big of an aircraft that is and how big of a feat that was at the time. When was that aircraft designed and built?
So I too, by the way, have visited the Evergreen Museum and seen the Spruce Goose, and it is a sight to see. I am still amazed by it to this day. What happened is during World War II, Howard Hughes wanted to be involved with the war effort, and you know, obviously making designing and making airplanes made a lot of sense for him, and he came up with the idea along with a few other people to create a transport plane that could transport troops across the Atlantic Ocean without the risk that, like, U-boats, you know, were going to shoot them down. A lot of things that were, what was happening was German U-boats were sinking American and other ships in the Atlantic because they're really defenseless. And so if we flew the troops over, you know, it would be safer. So the idea was to build a really, really big airplane and we could fly troops across the ocean. So Hughes got the contract along with Henry Kaiser, and they started developing what Hughes called the H-4, or the Hercules airplane. And one of the problems was that this was not the highest priority for the Defense Department at the time. And so they insisted that he build this plane out of wood rather than out of metal, because metal needed to go toward other things. And so Hughes and his crew came up with this Duramold type of wood that would create this plane. It was a super strong, super, it was very heavy, but it was still a good material for the plane. And the thing is, developing the H-4, the Hercules, took much longer than he was hoped and that the Defense Department hoped. And so it wasn't done by the end of the war. So after the war, you know, is over and people are starting to analyze where all the money was spent, there were some senators in Washington who were of the opinion that this was a boondoggle, that the Hercules was a waste of taxpayer money. And Hughes was summoned to Washington to defend himself in front of a Senate committee. Well, history goes will record that Hughes won the day decidedly in those Senate hearings, and that he made a very good case for himself, for his patriotism, and for the legitimacy of his airplane. And one of the things that he said was, if I don't fly this airplane, if this airplane doesn't fly, then he vowed he would leave the country and never come back. And so this is a pretty bold statement. Uh-huh. But Hughes went back to LA, Long Beach in this case, and he kept working on the airplane to the point where it was ready for a little test run in 1947. And at the time, he had invited the press out and other people out to witness this. And what had been advertised as just kind of, you know, moving around in the water of Long Beach Harbor and kind of showing off the airplane moving through the water, Hughes, in fact, intended to fly this airplane in front of everyone. So he ramps it up. It's going faster and faster. And he gets it up to 90 miles an hour. And the plane lifts off. It takes off into the air. And it was in the air for about a minute. There's video, you know, recording of this and still pictures of it proving that Hughes flew this airplane. It was this amazing accomplishment considering how big it was. And also the fact that he was using his own money to finish it, you know, millions of dollars he spent of his own money just to prove that this thing would fly.
And as I say, I don't know if people can quite appreciate how big of an aircraft this is, unless you compare it maybe to modern aircraft. So, having seen this thing and seeing the comparison size charts that were put together, I mean, this thing is about the same size as a Boeing 747, an Airbus A380, the big Russian Antonov air transports, and keeping in mind that those aircraft are all jet powered, this thing was propeller powered.
You know, I think even to this day, these comparisons are made with some of the biggest planes that have been made lately, and the Spruce Goose is right there with them. You know, it's still, there's nothing that's just dramatically bigger than it.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So we talked a little bit about, his airplane crashes and how that kind of led to his painkiller addiction. And this was kind of the beginnings of, as you mentioned, some of the other mental health issues that Howard Hughes had. He was known to be extremely obsessive compulsive and germophobia. That was a big thing for him too, wasn't it?
It was. And I think the germophobia really, and the obsessive compulsive disorder really became evident when he was a kid. And one of the things, of course, is his mother was kind of a germaphobe as well. And she really passed that on to her son. I think it might have had a not unrelated to the Spanish flu, and the other concerns at that time with different kinds of, you know, things that people were dealing with. And he was always then was concerned about germs. And this, I think, after the accident in 46, after he became more, dependent on drugs, it really exacerbated the obsessive compulsive disorder tendencies as well as the germophobia. And those are just a couple of reasons why he became very reclusive starting in the late 50s.
And one of the incidents that everybody kind of talks about with him in his that reclusiveness was when he locked himself away in a screening room for how many months was that he locked himself away? And that was in California, right?
Yeah, he had access to studios. You know, he was in the movie business and people knew him and they were willing to let him, you know, have access to these movie screening rooms. And he was at Goldwyn Studio, I believe, in L.A. And he was there for weeks at a time. And it was really him and it was the projectionist. And then Hughes would watch movies. And it's a very strange thing to think about, you know, hour after hour after hour in one place. But at the time, I think people have looked back and said, you know, Hughes was having a mental breakdown. Uh-huh. And he was such a difficult patient, as a, you know, as we may come back to, that, you know, he didn't really depend on doctors for a whole lot of treatment. And he, at that time, he probably should have been treated more properly. But instead, he sort of came up with his own idea, which is, I'm just going to watch movies for 8 weeks. It was, you know, it was very unusual. But by that time, Hughes had had more than one breakdown. And yeah, it was sort of just a whole roller coaster of his life, where he would, he'd be up and doing big things and you know, changing the world in many ways. And then there would be weeks and months would go by where he was in seclusion and nobody saw him.
I mean, I guess in a way he was kind of the inventor and the innovator of binge watching, wasn't he?
You know, it's true. I've thought about that as more recently with all the time we've been spending at home. And, you know, it's true. He had someone who he didn't have, obviously, Netflix or anything like that. But what he did have was a projectionist on staff and access to all the movies he could want. And so he would just order up a movie and they would play it.
It sounded crazy at the time, but in the world that we're in right now, it really doesn't seem all that far-fetched, does it?
Not really. And, you know, he would watch movies over and over again. He too, he became obsessed with certain movies and, you know, some of them, which he made, some of which were involved actors whom he knew or directors that he knew. And, you know, and he really liked, you know, kind of war movies and movies that involve flying, of course. And so, you know, that must have been annoying for projectionists when he would keep asking for the same movie over and over.
Let's move on to Howard Hughes and his association with Las Vegas. Before he arrived in Las Vegas and stayed there for the long term, he had been to Las Vegas prior to that, correct?
Yes. You know, the earliest hard evidence I have of Howard Hughes's visiting Las Vegas is 1941. I think he was definitely in Las Vegas before 1941, but definitely in 41, he landed at a local airport. And I have a great story in my book about that. And then he had the crash in 1943 at Lake Mead, and he was spending a lot of time in Vegas then. We also know he spent a lot of time in Las Vegas in late 40s and early 50s. He actually lived in Las Vegas for about a year in 1953 and 1954. He went so far as to acquire a house here, although the best evidence is that he never actually slept in the house. He would go over there occasionally to do work, but he slept in a suite at the Flamingo Hotel. So
really?
Yeah. So fast forward to 1966. In 1965, Hughes had sold all his shares in Trans World Airlines, TWA. And the amount of his shares, the value of his shares was $546 million, which is a lot of money today. But imagine how much money that was in 1965.
Wow.
And he it was described at the time as the largest single check that had ever been written to an individual. But of course, when you have $546 million all of a sudden, who wants a big chunk of that? Yeah, the Internal Revenue Service. So Hughes was looking for a way to avoid that huge penalty, that huge tax penalty. And he came up with the idea that he would move to Las Vegas, he moved to Nevada, and then he would invest that, a lot of that money into land and other properties. That's a way to avoid just giving it to the government. So Hughes, on Thanksgiving of 1966, he came to Las Vegas by train, believe it or not. You know, the great aviator insisted on coming to Las Vegas on a train. And he came in the middle of the night, and the train stopped a little ways outside of Las Vegas, where a van was waiting. And Hughes was transferred from the train to the van, and then he was driven. This was all in secret. People didn't know he was coming. And Hughes arrived at the Desert Inn Hotel on the burgeoning Las Vegas Strip and moved up into the ninth floor, which was the penthouse floor of the Desert Inn. And he was in one room, and his personal aides took up the rest of the ninth floor.
And some of the stories surrounding Howard Hughes are legendary enough, but the ones specifically involving Las Vegas are just crazy. One of the more prevalent ones, I guess you could say, is the story of him taking over the Desert Inn, them wanting him to leave, and him basically saying, no.
Well, that's right. You know, he moves into the penthouse suite of the Desert Inn. He takes up the entire penthouse floor. You know, the hotels in Las Vegas are a lot bigger now than they were then. So 9 stories was, you know, as big as you were going to get. But, you know, those rooms were valuable. They were very valuable to the Desert Inn because that's where their high rollers would stay when they came to gamble. But Hughes was not a high roller, and Hughes didn't gamble at all. He never left the room. And his aides were, they weren't gambling much either. They were guys who were very loyal to Hughes, and they were very focused on their jobs. They weren't spending a lot of money in the hotel, the casino. And so Mo Dalitz, the mob boss who ran the Desert Inn, he wanted Hughes out. He never intended that Hughes was going to live there. And so as the end of December is approaching, so remember, he came to Las Vegas on Thanksgiving of 66, late November. By mid-December, Mo Dalitz is concerned that these high rollers who are going to be coming in for New Year's, which is always a big deal here, he wants rooms for them. So he wants Hughes out. And Hughes doesn't want to leave. Hughes has become very comfortable at the Desert Inn. You know, there had been discussions with him and his right-hand man, Bob Mayhew, about moving into a house in Las Vegas. But I don't think Hughes was ever very serious about that. By this time of his life, he was pretty well accustomed to living in hotels. So it reaches a point in December where Mo Dalitz is about ready to send the sheriff in to physically evict Howard Hughes from the DI. And Bob Mayhew, that's the right-hand man of Hughes, he makes a call, the pivotal call, to try to avoid this conflict. He calls Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamsters Union boss,
right,
and asked him to intercede and allow Hughes, you know, and to talk down Mo Dalitz from kicking Hughes out. So Jimmy Hoffa does that. He makes that call. Mo Dalitz relents, and he's going to let Hughes stay. But it's right around this time that Hughes comes up with the idea, well, if they're going to kick me out of here, why don't I just buy the place and then I can stay? And so Hughes initiates proceedings to purchase the Desert Inn, and by March of 1967, it was his.
Jeez. That's amazing. I can't imagine just having that much money. You know what? I don't want to leave, so screw it. I'm just going to buy this place.
And that's exactly what happened. He stayed there in that suite the rest of the time he was in Las Vegas, about 4 years total. And so, of course, the Desert Inn didn't do that well while he owned it, in part because he had occupied all the good rooms. But
right.
He did own it. And he once he bought the Desert Inn, when he came to Las Vegas, he had no intention of buying casinos. But once he bought the Desert Inn, he decided that these were toys that he would really like to assemble. So he instructed Bob Mayhew to buy more casinos. And they ended up buying the Sands and the Frontier and the Silver Slipper and the Castaways and the Landmark. They also bought Harold's Club up in Reno.
Without VA, I would have paid $25,000 for my hospital stay,
$42,000 for my education,
$74,000 for my home down payment. But because of my service, I paid zero.
Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
There's a story that I've heard about him, the reason behind his purchase of the Silver Slipper. The story that I had read was that he bought it because he didn't like where the sign was. The blinking light of the sign kept him awake. Was that true?
So that I don't believe is true. And that story has traveled far and wide, though. So the Silver Slipper had a very interesting sign. It was a slipper, literally. It was a sign in the shape of a slipper, and it rotated. and there were lights on it. And it annoyed a lot of people, but there's no evidence that it annoyed Howard Hughes. And one of the reasons for that was that he, all of his windows of his suite were all covered. They were covered. He blacked out the room.
Gotcha.
So the likelihood that a light was bothering him is unlikely. What did in fact happen is Mayhew was looking for hotels to buy, and the Silver Slipper was available. That's kind of how that worked. Not every hotel on the Strip was available for Hughes to buy, but the ones that were, he went after them.
Now, I want to talk about Bob Mayhew just briefly here as well, because part of the deal was, I mean, obviously to order it, to own a casino, you have to have a gaming license.
Yes.
Hughes never left his room. There were people that worked for him that never saw him or actually talked to him. How did he manage to get these gaming licenses? Was it Bob Mayhew doing it for him, doing it in his name? How did that manage to work?
Yes, it's a great story, because a gaming license in Nevada is a privileged license. So not everybody can have a gaming license. You have to go through a great deal of a great background check. They want to find out, especially today, they want to find out, you know, about your criminal past or if there's anything fishy going on. What's more, part of the longstanding policy has been that if you're going to request a gaming license, you have to appear in person before the Gaming Control Board and the Nevada Gaming Commission. And they want to see you. They want to see that you're a genuine person and that they want to be able to question you. And this has been the practice for, you know, before and after Howard Hughes. You know, it doesn't matter how big of a character you are, whether you're Steve Wynn or Sheldon Adelson or Kirk Kerkorian, you had to go before the Gaming Control Board. Well, Hughes didn't want to do that. Hughes, of course, was very reclusive by this time. His health was bad. He wasn't keeping up his appearances very well, and he refused to go before the Gaming Control Board. Well, at the time, it was a bit of a crisis, because Nevada really wanted Howard Hughes to invest in Las Vegas and in Nevada. They really thought this was going to be a big deal for the state, which it was. And the governor at the time was Paul Axalt. And Paul Axalt decided that Bob Mayhew, the right-hand man for Hughes, could act in Hughes' stead, that he could appear before the Gaming Control Board as if he were Howard Hughes. And it was an exception that was granted by the governor only for Hughes. And I think the only time that's ever been done in Nevada.
And something else too, that kind of comes up with this, with Howard Hughes buying up all of these casinos and properties in Las Vegas, in a way he was kind of responsible for pushing the mob out of Las Vegas as well, wasn't he?
You know, he did. And that's an argument that I make that not every Hughes biographer makes, but I feel strongly about it, because I've looked at each of these transactions that Hughes made, the purchases that he made on the Strip. And in each case, the mob was involved. In other words, the mob had been involved with that casino. And when Hughes bought it, they were no longer in an ownership position at that casino. And so this was him nudging the mob out of these Strip resorts. Now, of course, the mob continued to be involved in other resorts on the Strip and up into the 80s. But, you know, this was the first thing Hughes did, is he physically bought these casinos away from the mob. But there was a bigger impact of his arrival. And that was, he opened the door for mainstream American companies to consider investing in Las Vegas. I mean, before that, one of the reasons the mob had such an influence here is because, you know, mainstream companies would not invest in Las Vegas. Casinos would be bad for their image. It would be like, you know, it would be almost like a criminal thing in their mind. Keep in mind, at the time, 49 other states, gambling was illegal at that point.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely reversed now. And gambling is legal in one shape or form in 48 of our states. But at the time, you know, gambling was still a sin, right? You didn't talk about it if you did it. And so what Hughes did is said, here I am. I'm a well-known, well-respected, mainstream American entrepreneur, and I'm investing in casinos. if it's okay for Howard Hughes, maybe it's okay for other mainstream companies to get involved. And so I believe he opened that door. And what you saw very quickly in the 1970s is a number of other hotel chains. You know, the Hilton chain came in and invested here, Ramada invested here, and other hotel companies, as well as other mainstream companies, decided that Las Vegas was a smart investment. So Hughes nudged the mob out in that way as well, because these other companies had a lot more money than the mob did, and they had a lot less scrutiny, and they were able to make greater investments and get more done here to grow Las Vegas.
And it wasn't just casinos and hotels that Hughes invested in Las Vegas as well. I mean, he bought land, he bought real estate, he bought a TV station. He did a lot of investing into Las Vegas and the surrounding areas.
He definitely did. He bought an airport. He bought mining claims all over the state. He had an idea that he would buy old mining claims and then kind of find a technology to go back and mine additional gold and silver out of those mines. He was a little ahead of his time, because that actually is being done today, what they call microscopic gold, right? So we have a very big mining industry in Nevada today doing exactly what Hughes wanted to do in the late 60s, but he didn't have the technology. Anyway, he bought mining claims, he bought an airport, he bought land, and he bought a TV station, Channel 8, the CBS affiliate here. And there's an amazing story associated with that. Hughes wanted to control the movies that were played in the late night period on that TV station. he was a guy who often would have long bouts of insomnia, and sort of echoing back to that time when he was watching movies at Goldwyn Studio in LA, at night he would sit there and watch the late night movies from, you know, midnight to 5 a.m. or whatever it was, but they weren't playing the movies that he wanted them to play. So in order for him to be able to control what movies were played, he had to own the station. So he ended up buying the station from a man named Hank Greenspun, who was a local newspaper publisher who also owned the TV station. Hughes bought the station from him. And then every day, Hughes would receive a list from the station of the available movies for that night's late night movie session. And Hughes then would go through the list and he would mark the ones he wanted to show. Sometimes he wouldn't like anything on the list and he would demand another list. there was one infamous occasion where one night Hughes was watching the late night movies and he fell asleep during one of the movies. And when he woke up, the movie was over. So he had missed it. So he called the station and he demanded that they replay that movie. So imagine you're a regular person in Las Vegas and maybe you work the swing shift. So you're up at night and, you know, this movie that you just watched, you know, it's on again. It's like they're showing it again. What in the world would they do that for? Well, it was because behind the scenes, Howard Hughes had demanded that they do that.
Wow.
So he always took great liberties with the companies he owned. I mean, he could do whatever he wanted. He was the owner.
Unbelievable. And of course, too, his intelligence and his knowledge and his brilliance, he took a lot of that and made some major contributions to the academic and the educational system in the state of Nevada as well, didn't he?
Well, he made, yes. His biggest contribution, I think, from an academic standpoint in Nevada was University of Nevada Medical School, and really based in Reno, but also with down here. And we didn't have a medical school before Hughes came. And as part of him building sort of his PR effort in Nevada, he agreed to donate a large sum of money, hundreds of thousands, to build a medical school in Nevada. We didn't have one at all. And today, the University of Nevada School of Medicine is a great medical school. And we have now a new medical school going in Las Vegas, you know, separate but related. And, you know, it was really Hughes who got that going. Another thing that he did was he was the first to invest in our community college system here. And that started in Elko, Nevada, which is in far northeastern Nevada. They had a community college out there that was struggling financially. And again, as kind of a goodwill gesture, Hughes agreed to pump some money into that community college. Well, that community college ended up growing into the community college system that we have throughout the state today, with, you know, probably 100,000 students or more going to all these different schools. So Hughes was very important to Nevada in that way. He was not a tremendous philanthropist here, but he did do those two things, which are very important.
So let's talk a little bit about Hughes leaving Las Vegas. What were the circumstances surrounding his decision to leave the city of Las Vegas? And did he sneak away in as secret of a way as he arrived? Did people know he was leaving? How did that all sort of go down?
Hughes left Las Vegas right around Thanksgiving of 1970. And the reason for him leaving, I don't think he wanted to leave, but he had a falling out with Bob Mayhew, his right-hand man. And it's a long story, but the short version is that Mayhew's colleagues, the other executives within the Hughes empire, were very jealous of Mayhew and his stature within Hughes's world. And there was some palace intrigue in which some of the other executives, a man named Bill Gay, another man named Chester Davis, who was a lawyer for Hughes, really conspired against Mayhew to make him look bad in Hughes's eyes. And when this happened, Hughes was very concerned about Mayhew. Like, if they're going to fire Mayhew, he's very concerned that Mayhew is going to come back hard at Hughes. And so Hughes, the sort of decision was made, I need to get out of town. I need to get, you know, that Mayhew could come back at him, you know, with lawsuits, and that he might be forced to testify in court. He didn't want that. He wanted to get as far away as he could from the situation. So in November of 1970, Hughes secretly gets on an airplane at Nellis Air Force Base, to the northeast of Las Vegas, and takes off and ultimately leaves the country, goes to the Bahamas. And nobody knows he's gone at first. It's just as mysterious as when he came. But a few days after he left, the news started filtering out into the local press that Hughes had left the city. And at the time, suspected that Hughes had been kidnapped. Remember, at this time, Mayhew is suddenly on the outs, and he doesn't know why. He's trying to figure out what's going on, and he's concerned about these other executives and what they might have done. And he accuses accuses these guys of kidnapping Hughes and taking him away. And he's demanding, you know, that the government look into it, and, you know, CIA and everybody else. Well, I don't think Hughes was kidnapped, not in the classic sense of the term, anyway. He was manipulated into leaving, but he wasn't kidnapped. And so that's how he left. It left it under a cloud, and it really hurt Mayhew. A lot of legal proceedings followed that. And Mayhew, you know, on one hand came out on the right side there. He won the legal battle. But on the other hand, his reputation in town was shot, and he just never quite recovered from that the way you would hope. I mean, he was the biggest business executive in Nevada, you know, for 4 years. And then suddenly he's a nobody.
And so was the Bahamas basically where Howard Hughes finished out the rest of his life? Is that where he ended up passing away, or is there more to the story?
Actually, no, he was traveled around a bit. It was sort of unusual, but he was in the Bahamas. He was in Nicaragua. He was in London. He lived in London for a while, and at that time was a real bright spot for him. You know, his health had been deteriorating, and, you know, things were not going well. His addictions were really getting the best of him. But he had a lighter moment in London where things, where people were, who were observing him, felt like, hey, here's a guy who might be pulling out of this a little bit. And he actually flew an airplane a couple of times when he was in London. It was all set up with another pilot, and the elderly Hughes gets into the other pilot seat, and they flew around Europe a couple of times. Unfortunately, not long after those flights, Hughes had a fall and he broke his hip. And from that point on, he never stood up again. He was in bed the rest of his life. Yeah, but he ended up traveling from London back to Central America, and then to ultimately to Acapulco, Mexico.
And so then, was it in Acapulco where he passed away, or again, in typical Howard Hughes fashion, is there more to this story? And I guess the other question, how old was Howard Hughes when he did pass away?
I think he was 70 years old. But what's interesting is he did not die in Acapulco, but he was more or less in a coma. His health had deteriorated so badly. His doctors had done such a poor job of doing their job. You know, they just were not taking good care of him. And he was deteriorating at a rapid rate, finally to the extent where they were so concerned that he was going to die that they got him onto a plane there in Acapulco, and they raced toward Houston. The idea was to go to the Houston hospital in Houston and then hopefully bring him back to health. Well, about three quarters of the way into the flight, Hughes expired. And so they ended up bringing a corpse back into the United States. But unfortunately for Hughes, last year and a half were a time where he was not really spending much time conversing with people. He was in a very bad state. And the aides were not, you know, blowing the whistle on this. The executives were taking advantage in his companies of his not being involved. And it's all very ugly business.
And so when he passed away, after all of these years and all of these investments and all of this work that he had done, and then all of this traveling that he had done, what was his net worth believed to be at the time of his death?
That is a subject that has never been fully, that number has never been fully agreed upon. But, you know, he was, by all intents and purposes, a billionaire with the companies that he had owned. I think he was richer, you know, 5 to 10 years before he died than when he did die, because he had passed on, you know, Hughes Tool Company was no longer under his control at that point, which was always the basis for everything with him. But Hughes was the bigger issue was, like, we know the guy was super rich, whether it's, you know, 500 million or 1.5 billion or 3 billion, everybody wanted this money. And there was no will that could be found that was a legitimate will. And this is, there's a whole, you know, separate book to be written about that. But, you know, everybody's looking for a will. And nobody's finding a legitimate will, because Hughes never signed one. He never completed the process. He had started the process. He did a will as early as when he was in his 20s. And then he had other attempts at putting together a will, but he never wrapped up the process. And so when he died, ultimately the judge had to decide that his heirs would be his family members. And then there was a battle about who is a family member and who isn't. Ultimately, the judge decided that there were 22 legitimate heirs to Howard Hughes. And these individuals were people who had never met him in his whole life. There were people who had not talked to him in decades. And the executor of the will, executor of the estate, was a cousin of his named Will Lummis. And what's interesting about Will Lummis is he was a really good stand-up guy. But he looked a lot like his cousin. He looked a lot like Howard, and he acted like Howard to a large extent. But they had only met one time when Will Lummis was a kid, and he was a young adult. and they'd never talked since. Well, Will Lummis ended up taking over the estate, and they sold a lot of stuff that Hughes had. He had airplanes stashed all over the country. He had property he owned all over the country. He had the casinos on the Las Vegas Strip, which they sold. The TV station they sold, et cetera. They ended up keeping one very important piece of property, and that was a 25,000-acre piece of property on the west side of Las Vegas. And that became one of the major legacies of Hughes's involvement with Las Vegas.
And so then is that area now what's known as the suburb or the city of Summerlin?
Yes. So the Summerlin, the heirs to Hughes with Will Lummis at the lead decided that they would keep this piece of property and that they would develop it. Las Vegas was then growing and had a huge potential, growth potential, not only for people to come to casinos, but to actually live here. And with 25,000 acres and a nice area of the valley here, they decided that this would become a master plan community to rival any of the biggest and best ones in the country. And that proved to be true. The amazing thing about Summerlin is that it's still not finished. They're still building houses out in Summerlin. I think they still probably have about 5 more years of development before it's finally done. So, I don't happen to live in Summerlin, but a lot of people I know do live there. It's a wonderful community, schools and churches and businesses and manufacturing and baseball field and, like a minor league baseball field, hockey practice arena, all kinds of great stuff in Summerlin. And it's really become one of the centerpieces of Las Vegas.
And I mean, Summerlin really isn't the only place that carries Howard Hughes' legacy in Las Vegas. I mean, you can't go anywhere in the city without seeing something, it seems like, with the Hughes name on it.
Yeah, his heirs donated money to UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, to their engineering department. So if you go to the engineering department, you'll see his name, Howard Hughes Engineering School. He also built a number of business parks here and also a very like a high-end business park, which is called Hughes Center, just off the strip. And he used to own an airport here, what's now called North Las Vegas Airport. It was it's now owned by the county, but at the time Hughes had it. So people remember that. A lot of street names in Summerlin are referred to parts of his life, people in his life, aspects of his life, which is kind of fun. And even the Summerlin Library, the community library there, has one of the most extensive exhibits about Hughes's life. It's mostly about his aviation career. It's a wonderful exhibit. And that was a partnership between the library and the Hughes Corporation. I should note that the Howard Hughes Corporation is still here, building Summerlin and involved in some other activities here too. It's the ownership of that is not tied to the heirs anymore, but they've retained the name Howard Hughes, I think, because it does well for them.
If people want to take a really, really deep dive into the world of Howard Hughes, you have a book available on Amazon, and you actually just released a new version of the book, correct?
That is correct. The new one is the one I like the original edition, but the new edition is updated substantially, and it's longer, more material, and it's called Howard Hughes, Power, Paranoia, and Palace Intrigue, and it's published by University of Nevada Press. Very proud of it. The original edition came out in 2008. And what's funny about that is as soon as that book came out, people came out of the woodwork to tell me more stories about Howard Hughes. And they wanted to relate new angles that I had not pursued in the first edition. So I was very lucky to be able to do another edition. It's longer and it's updated. A couple of mistakes are fixed. Really like this new edition. So what it does is it covers almost every aspect of Hughes's life. And it's not just Las Vegas, although that's a big part of it, but everything else as well.
And the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas, of which you are the vice president of exhibits and programs, has quite an extensive Howard Hughes collection as well.
Yes, we recently redid our Howard Hughes exhibit, something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. And so that's actually very new for people who haven't been to the museum recently. When they come again, they'll see a brand new Hughes exhibit.
Excellent. Jeff, if people want to find the Mob Museum online, you guys, of course, you're on social media and online. Where can people find you?
Yes, our website is themobmuseum.org. You got to have the T-H-E in there, themobmuseum.org. And we have a lot of great material on the website, but also a place where you can buy tickets once we reopen. And then we're on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And we're not hard to find. And a lot of the social media content that we put out is very informative, very educational. So if anybody wants to hook up with any of those feeds, I think you'd find it entertaining.
Excellent. Well, Jeff, thank you again for taking the time to jump on today and chat about Howard Hughes and a very, very cool character in the history of Las Vegas.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time with me. I love talking about this. Hold to my breath.